the angel came. She walked across the clearing from the east, dressed in a long winter cloak of blanched wool, almost white. He watched her approach without surprise or curiosity. He was beyond wonder or fear. He looked at her with the dull, vacant, emotionless gaze he had bestowed upon the massive trunks of the surrounding oaks. Her oval face was framed with rich dark hair, and her cloak hid her feet, so that she might have been gliding over the dead leaves. She stopped right in front of him, and her pale gold eyes seemed to see into his soul and understand his pain. She looked familiar, as if he might have seen a picture of this very angel in some church he had attended recently. Then she opened her cloak. Underneath it, she was naked. She had the body of an earthly woman in her middle twenties with pale skin and pink nipples. Tom had always assumed angels' bodies to be immaculately hairless, but this one was not. She went down on one knee in front of him where he sat cross-legged by the oak tree. Leaning toward him, she kissed his mouth. He was too stunned by previous shocks to feel surprise even at this. She pushed him back gently until he was lying flat. Then she opened her cloak and lay on top of him with her naked body pressed against him. He felt the heat of her body through his undertunic. After a few moments he stopped shivering. She took his bearded face in her hands and kissed him again, thirstily, like someone drinking cool water after a long, dry day. After a moment she ran her hands down his arms to his wrists, then lifted his hands to her breasts. He grasped them reflexively. They were soft and yielding, and her nipples swelled under his fingertips. In the back of his mind he conceived the idea that he was dead. Heaven was not supposed to be like this, he knew, but he hardly cared. His critical faculties had been disengaged for hours. What little capacity he had left for rational thought vanished, and he let his body take charge. He strained upward, pressing his body against hers, drawing strength from her heat and her nakedness. She opened her mouth and thrust her tongue inside his mouth, seeking his tongue, and he responded eagerly. She pulled away from him briefly, raising her body off his. He watched, dazed, as she pushed up the skirt of his undertunic until it was around his waist. Then she straddled his hips. She looked into his eyes with her all-seeing gaze as she lowered herself. There was a tantalizing moment when their bodies touched, and she hesitated. Then he felt himself enter her. The sensation was so thrilling, he felt he might burst with pleasure. She moved her hips, smiling at him and kissing his face. After a while, she closed her eyes and started to pant, and he understood that she was losing control. He watched in delighted fascination. She uttered small rhythmic cries, moving faster and faster, and her ecstasy moved Tom to the depths of his wounded soul, so that he did not know whether he wanted to weep with despair, or shout for joy, or laugh hysterically. And then an explosion of delight shook them both, like trees in a gale, again and again, until at last their passion subsided, and she slumped on his chest. They lay like that for a long time. The heat of her body warmed him right through. He drifted into a kind of light sleep. It seemed short and more like daydreaming than real sleep, but when he opened his eyes his mind was clear. He looked at the beautiful young woman lying on top of him, and he knew immediately that she was not an angel, but the outlaw woman Ellen, whom he had met in this part of the forest on the day the pig was stolen. She felt him stir and opened her eyes, regarding him with an expression of mingled affection and anxiety. He suddenly thought of his children. He rolled Ellen off him gently and sat up. Alfred and Martha lay on the leaves, wrapped in their cloaks, with the sun shining on their sleeping faces. Then the events of the night came back to him in a rush of horror, and he remembered that Agnes was dead, and the baby, his son, was gone, and he buried his face in his hands. He heard Ellen give a strange two-tone whistle. He looked up. A figure emerged from the forest, and Tom recognized her peculiar-looking son, Jack. with his dead white skin and orange hair and bright bird-like blue eyes. Tom got up, rearranging his clothing, and Ellen stood and closed up her cloak. The boy was carrying something, and he brought it across and showed it to Tom. Tom recognized it. It was the half of his cloak in which he had wrapped the baby before placing it on Agnes's grave. Uncomprehending, Tom stared at the boy and then at Ellen. She took his hand in hers, looked into his eyes, and said, "Your baby is alive." Tom did not dare to believe her. It would be too wonderful, too happy for this world. "He can't be," he said. "He is." Tom began to hope. "Truly," he said. "Truly." She nodded. "Truly. I will take you to him." Tom realized she meant it. A flood of relief and happiness washed over him. He fell to his knees on the ground, and then at last, like the opening of a floodgate, he wept. 5.
"Jack heard the baby cry," Ellen explained. "He was on his way to the river, to a place north of here, where you can kill ducks with stones if you're a good shot. He didn't know what to do, so he ran home to fetch me. But while we were on our way back to the spot, we saw a priest riding a palfrey carrying the baby." Tom said, "I must find him."
"Don't panic," Ellen said. "I know where he is. He took a side turning quite near the grave, a path that leads to a little monastery hidden in the forest. The baby needs milk. The monks have goats."
"Thank God," Tom said fervently.
"I'll take you there, after you've had something to eat," she said. "But," she frowned, "don't tell your children about the monastery just yet."
Tom glanced across the clearing. Alfred and Martha slept on. Jack had drifted across to where they lay, and he was staring at them in his vacant way.
"Why not?"
"I'm not sure. I just think it might be wiser to wait."
"But your son will tell them."
She shook her head. "He saw the priest, but I don't think he's worked out the rest of it."
"All right." Tom felt solemn. "If I'd known you were nearby, you might have saved my Agnes."
Ellen shook her head, and her dark hair danced around her face. "There was nothing to be done, except to keep the woman warm, and you did that. When a woman is bleeding inside, either it stops and she gets better, or it doesn't, and she dies."
Tears came to Tom's eyes, and Ellen said,
"I'm sorry."
Tom nodded dumbly. She said, "But the living must take care of the living, and you need hot food and a new coat."
She stood up.
They woke the children. Tom told them that the baby was all right, that Ellen and Jack had seen a priest carrying him, and that Tom and Ellen were going to go looking for the priest later. But first, Ellen was going to give them food. They accepted the startling news calmly. Nothing could shock them now. Tom was no less bemused. Life was moving too fast for him to take in all the changes. It was like being on the back of a runaway horse. Everything happened so quickly that there was no time to react to events, and all he could do was hold on tightly and try to stay sane. Agnes had given birth in the cold night air. The baby had been born miraculously healthy. Everything had seemed all right. And then Agnes, Tom's soulmate, had bled to death in his arms, and he had lost his mind. The baby had been doomed and left for dead. Then they had tried to find it and failed. Then Ellen had appeared and Tom had taken her for an angel, and they had made love as if in a dream, and she had said the baby was alive and well. Would life ever slow down enough to let Tom think about these awful events? They set off. Tom had always assumed that outlaws lived in squalor, but there was nothing squalid about Ellen, and Tom wondered what her home would be like. She led them on a zigzag course through the forest. There was no path, but she never hesitated as she stepped over streams, ducked low branches, and negotiated a frozen swamp, a massive shrubbery, and the enormous trunk of a fallen oak. Finally, she walked toward a bramble thicket and seemed to vanish into it. Following her, Tom saw that, contrary to his first impression, there was a narrow passageway winding through the thicket. He followed her. The brambles closed over his head, and he found himself in semi-darkness. He stood still, waiting for his eyes to adjust to the gloom. Gradually he realized he was in a cave.
The air was warm. Ahead of him a fire glowed on a hearth of flat stones. The smoke was going straight upward. There was a natural chimney somewhere. On either side of him were animal skins, a wolf and a deer, fixed to the walls of the cave with wooden pegs. A haunch of smoked venison hung from the roof above him. He saw a homemade box full of crab apples, rushlights on ledges, and dry reeds on the floor. At the edge of the fire was a cooking pot, just as there would be in any ordinary household, and judging by the smell it contained the same kind of pottage as everyone else ate, vegetables boiled with meat bones and herbs. Tom was astonished. This was a home more comfortable than those of many serfs. Beyond the fire were two mattresses made of deerskin and stuffed presumably with reeds, and neatly rolled on top of each was a wolf fur. Ellen and Jack would sleep there with the fire between them and the mouth of the cave. At the back of the cave was a formidable collection of weapons and hunting gear, a bow, some arrows, nets, rabbit traps, several wicked daggers, a carefully made wooden lance with its tip sharpened and fire-hardened, and among all those primitive implements, three books. Tom was flabbergasted. He had never seen books in a house, let alone a cave. Books belonged in church. The boy Jack picked up a wooden bowl, dipped it into the pot, and began to drink. Alfred and Martha watched him hungrily. Ellen gave Tom an apologetic look and said, "Jack, when there are strangers, we give them food first before we eat." The boy stared at her, mystified. "Why?" "Because it's a gentle thing to do. Give the children some pottage." Jack was not convinced, but he obeyed his mother. Ellen gave some soup to Tom. He sat down on the floor and drank. It tasted meaty and warmed him from the inside. Ellen put a fur around his shoulders. When he had drunk the juice, he fished out the vegetables and meat with his fingers. It was weeks since he had tasted meat. This seemed to be duck, shot by Jack with stones and a sling, presumably. They ate until the pot was empty. Then Alfred and Martha lay down on the rushes. Before they fell asleep, Tom told them that he and Ellen were going to look for the priest, and Ellen said Jack would stay here and take care of them until the parents returned. The two exhausted children nodded assent and closed their eyes. Tom and Ellen went out, Tom wearing the fur Ellen had given him draped over his shoulders to keep him warm. As soon as they were out of the bramble thicket, Ellen stopped, turned to Tom, pulled his head down to hers, and kissed his mouth. "I love you," she said fiercely. "I loved you from the moment I saw you. I always wanted a man who would be strong and gentle, and I thought there was no such thing. Then I saw you. I wanted you. But I could see you loved your wife. My God, how I envied her. I'm sorry she died, truly sorry, because I can see the grief in your eyes, and all the tears waiting to be shed, and it breaks my heart to see you so sad. But now that she's gone, I want you for myself." Tom did not know what to say. It was hard to believe that a woman so beautiful and resourceful and self-sufficient should have fallen in love with him at first sight. Harder still to know how he felt. He was devastated by the loss of Agnes. Ellen was right to say that he had unshed tears. He could feel their weight behind his eyes. But he was also consumed by desire for Ellen, with her wonderful hot body and her golden eyes and her shameless lust. He felt dreadfully guilty about wanting Ellen so badly when Agnes was only hours in her grave. He stared back at her, and once again her eyes saw into his heart, and she said, "Don't say anything. You don't have to feel ashamed. I know you loved her. She knew it too, I could tell." "You still love her? Of course you do. You always will." She had told him not to say anything, and in any case he had nothing to say. He was struck dumb by this extraordinary woman. She seemed to make everything all right. Somehow the fact that she appeared to know everything that was in his heart made him feel better, as if now he had nothing more to be ashamed of. He sighed. "That's better," she said. She took him by the hand, and they walked away from the cave together. They pushed through the virgin forest for almost a mile, then came to the road. As they walked along, Tom kept looking at Ellen's face beside him. He recalled that when he first met her, he had thought she fell short of being beautiful because of her strange eyes. Now he could not understand how he had ever felt that. He now saw those astonishing eyes as the perfect expression of her unique self. Now she seemed absolutely perfect, and the only puzzle was why she was with him. They walked for 3 or 4 miles. Tom was still tired, but the pottage had given him strength, and although he trusted Ellen completely, he was still anxious to see the baby with his own eyes. When they could see the monastery through the trees, Ellen said, "Let's not reveal ourselves to the monks at first." Tom was mystified. "Why? You abandoned a baby. It counts as murder. Let's spy on the place from the woods and see what kind of people they are." Tom did not think he was going to be in trouble, given the circumstances, but there was no harm in being cautious, so he nodded assent and followed Ellen into the undergrowth. A few moments later they were lying at the edge of the clearing. It was a very small monastery. Tom had built monasteries, and he guessed this one must be what they called a cell, a branch or outpost of a large priory or abbey. There were only 2 stone buildings, the chapel and the dormitory. The rest were made of wood and wattle and daub, a kitchen, stables, a barn, and a range of smaller agricultural buildings. The place had a clean, well-kept look, and gave the impression that the monks did as much farming as praying. "There were not many people about. Most of the monks have gone to work," Ellen said. "They're building a barn at the top of the hill." She glanced up at the sky. "They'll be back around noon for their dinner." Tom scanned the clearing. Over to their right, partly concealed by a small herd of tethered goats, he saw 2 figures. "Look," he said, pointing. As they studied the 2 figures, he saw something else. "The man sitting down is a priest, and he's holding something in his lap. Let's go closer." They moved through the woods, skirting the clearing, and emerged at a point close to the goats. Tom's heart was in his mouth as he looked at the priest sitting on a stool. He had a baby in his lap, and the baby was Tom's. There was a lump in Tom's throat. It was true. It really was. The baby had lived. He felt like throwing his arms around the priest and hugging him. There was a young monk with the priest. Looking closely, Tom saw that the youngster was dipping a rag into a pail of milk, goat's milk, presumably, and then putting the sodden corner of the rag into the baby's mouth. That was ingenious. "Well," Tom said apprehensively, "I'd better go and own up to what I've done and take my son back." Ellen looked at him levelly. "Think for a moment, Tom," she said. "What are you going to do then?" He was not sure what she was getting at. "Ask the monks for milk," he said. "They can see I'm poor. They give alms." "And then?" "Well, I hope they'll give me enough milk to keep him alive for 3 days until I get to Winchester."
"And after that," she persisted, "how will you feed the baby then?"
"Well, I'll look for work." "You've been looking for work since last time I met you, at the end of the summer," she said. She seemed to be a little angry with Tom. He could not see why.
"You've no money and no tools," she went on. "What will happen to the baby if there's no work in Winchester?"
"I don't know," Tom said. He felt hurt that she could speak so harshly to him. "What am I to do? Live like you? I can't shoot ducks with a stone. I'm a mason."
"You could leave the baby here," she said.
Tom was thunderstruck.
"Leave him," he said,
"when I've only just found him.
You'd be sure he'd be warm and fed. You wouldn't have to carry him while you look for work. And when you do find something, you can come back here and fetch the child."
Tom's instinct rebelled against the whole idea. "I don't know," he said. "What would the monks think of my abandoning the baby?"
"They already know you did that," she said impatiently. "It's just a question of whether you confess now or later."
"The monks know how to take care of babies. They know as much about it as you do." "I doubt it. Well, they've worked out how to feed a newborn who can only suck." Tom began to see that she was right. Much as he longed to hold the tiny bundle in his arms, he could not deny that the monks were better able to care for the baby than he was. He had no food and no money and no sure prospect of getting work.
"Leave him again," he said sadly. "I suppose I must."
He stayed where he was, gazing across the clearing at the small figure in the priest's lap. It had dark hair, like Agnes's hair. Tom had made up his mind, but now he could not tear himself away. Then a large group of monks appeared on the far side of the clearing, 15 or 20 of them, carrying axes and saws, and suddenly there was a danger that Tom and Ellen would be seen. They ducked back into the undergrowth. Now Tom could no longer see the baby. They crept away through the bushes. When they came to the road, they broke into a run. They ran for 300 or 400 yards, holding hands. Then Tom was exhausted. They were at a safe distance, however. They stepped off the road and found a place to rest out of sight. They sat down on a grassy bank lit by dappled sunlight. Tom looked at Ellen lying on her back, breathing hard, her cheeks flushed, her lips smiling up at him. Her robe had fallen open at the neck, revealing her throat and the swell of one breast. Suddenly he felt a compulsion to look at her nakedness again, and the desire was much stronger than the guilt he felt. He leaned over to kiss her, then hesitated, because she was so lovely to look at. When he spoke, it was unpremeditated, and his own words took him by surprise. "Ellen," he said, "will you be my wife?"
Chapter 2 Peter of Wareham was a born troublemaker. He had been transferred to the little cell in the forest from the mother house at Kingsbridge, and it was easy to see why the prior of Kingsbridge had been anxious to get rid of him. A tall, rangy man in his late 20s, he had a powerful intellect and a scornful manner, and he lived in a permanent state of righteous indignation. When he first arrived and started working in the fields, he had set a furious pace, and then accused others of laziness. However, to his surprise, most of the monks had been able to keep up with him, and eventually the younger ones had tired him out. He had then looked for a vice other than idleness, and his second choice had been gluttony. He began by eating only half his bread and none of his meat. He drank water from streams during the day, diluted his beer, and refused wine. He reprimanded a healthy young monk who asked for more porridge, and reduced to tears a boy who playfully drank another's wine. The monks showed little evidence of gluttony, Prior Philip thought, as they walked back from the hilltop to the monastery at dinner time. The youngsters were lean and muscular, and the older men were sunburned and wiry. Not one of them had the pale, soft roundness that came from having plenty to eat and nothing to do. Philip thought all monks should be thin. Fat monks provoked poor men to envy and hatred of God's servants. Characteristically, Peter had disguised his accusation as a confession. "I have been guilty of the sin of gluttony," he had said this morning, when they were taking a break, sitting on the trees they had felled, eating rye bread and drinking beer. "I have disobeyed the rule of St. Benedict, which says that monks must not eat meat nor drink wine." He looked around at the others, his head high and his dark eyes blazing with pride, and he let his gaze rest finally on Philip. "And everyone here is guilty of the same sin," he finished. It was very sad that Peter should be like this, Philip thought. The man was dedicated to God's work, and he had a fine mind and great strength of purpose, but he seemed to have a compelling need to feel special and be noticed by others all the time, and this drove him to create scenes. He was a real nuisance, but Philip loved him as much as any of them, for Philip could see behind the arrogance and the scorn a troubled soul who did not really believe that anyone could possibly care for him. Philip had said, "This gives us an opportunity to recall what St. Benedict said on this topic. Do you remember his exact words, Peter?" "He says, all but the sick should abstain from meat. And then, wine is not the drink of monks at all," Peter replied. Philip nodded. As he had suspected, Peter did not know the rule as well as Philip. "Almost correct, Peter," he said. "The saint did not refer to meat, but to the flesh of four-footed animals. And even so he made exceptions, not just for the sick, but also for the weak." "What did he mean by the weak?"
Here in our little community we take the view that men who have been weakened by strenuous work in the fields may need to eat beef now and then to keep up their strength.
Peter had listened to this in sullen silence, his brow creased with disapproval, his heavy black eyebrows drawn together over the bridge of his large, curved nose, his face a mask of suppressed defiance. Philip had gone on the subject of wine, the saint says, "We read that wine is not the drink of monks at all." The use of the words, "we read," implies that he does not wholly endorse the proscription. He also says that a pint of wine a day should be sufficient for anyone, and he warns us not to drink to satiety. It is clear, is it not, that he does not expect monks to abstain totally.
But he says that frugality should be maintained in everything, Peter said.
And you say we are not frugal here? Philip asked him.
I do, he said in a ringing voice.
Let those to whom God gives the gift of abstinence know that they shall receive their proper reward, Philip quoted. If you feel that the food here is too generous, you may eat less. But remember what else the saint says. He quotes the first epistle to the Corinthians, in which St. Paul says, everyone has his proper gift from God, one thus, another thus. And then the saint tells us, for this reason the amount of other people's food cannot be determined without some misgiving. Please remember that, Peter, as you fast and meditate upon the sin of gluttony. They had gone back to work then, Peter wearing a martyred air. He was not going to be silenced so easily, Philip realized. Of the monk's three vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, the one that gave Peter trouble was obedience. There were ways of dealing with disobedient monks, of course. Solitary confinement, bread and water, flogging, and ultimately excommunication and expulsion from the house. Philip did not normally hesitate to use such punishments, especially when a monk seemed to be testing Philip's authority. Consequently, he was thought of as a tough disciplinarian, but in fact he hated meting out punishment. It brought disharmony into the monastic brotherhood and made everyone unhappy. Anyway, in the case of Peter, punishment would do no good at all. Indeed, it would serve to make the man more prideful and unforgiving. Philip had to find a way to control Peter and soften him at the same time. It would not be easy. But then, he thought, if everything were easy, men would not need God's guidance. They reached the clearing in the forest where the monastery was. As they walked across the open space, Philip saw Brother John waving energetically at them from the goat pen. He was called Johnny Eightpence, and he was a little soft in the head. Philip wondered what he was excited about now. With Johnny was a man in priest's robes. He looked vaguely familiar, and Philip hurried toward him. The priest was a short, compact man in his middle twenties, with close-cropped black hair and bright blue eyes that twinkled with alert intelligence. Looking at him was, for Philip, like looking in a mirror. The priest, he realized with a shock, was his younger brother Francis, and Francis was holding a newborn baby. Philip did not know which was more surprising, Francis or the baby. The monks all crowded around. Francis stood up and handed the baby to Johnny. Then Philip embraced him. "What are you doing here?" Philip said delightedly. "And why have you got a baby?"
"I'll tell you later why I'm here," Francis said. "As for the baby, I found him in the woods, all alone, lying near a blazing fire."
Francis stopped.
"And?"
Philip prompted him.
Francis shrugged. "I can't tell you any more than that, because that's all I know. I was hoping to get here last night, but I didn't quite make it, so I spent the night in a verderer's hut. I left at dawn this morning, and I was riding along the road when I heard a baby cry. A moment later I saw it. I picked it up and brought it here. That's the whole tale."
Philip looked incredulously at the tiny bundle in Johnny's arms. He reached out a hand, tentatively, and lifted a corner of the blanket. He saw a wrinkled pink face, an open, toothless mouth, and a little bald head, a miniature of an aging monk. He unwrapped the bundle a little more and saw tiny, fragile shoulders, waving arms, and tight-clenched fists.
He looked closely at the stump of the umbilical cord which hung from the baby's navel. It was faintly disgusting. Was this natural? Philip wondered. It looked like a wound that was healing well and would be best left alone. He pulled the blanket down farther still. A boy, he said with an embarrassed cough and covered it up again. One of the novices giggled. Philip suddenly felt helpless. What on earth am I to do with it? He thought. Feed it? The baby cried, and the sound tugged at his heartstrings like a well-loved hymn. It's hungry, he said, and he thought in the back of his mind, how did I know that? One of the monks said, we can't feed it. Philip was about to say, why not? Then he realized why not. There were no women for miles. However, Johnny had already solved that problem, Philip now saw. Johnny sat down on the stool with the baby in his lap. He had in his hand a towel with one corner twisted into a spiral. He dipped the corner into a pail of milk, let the towel soak up some of the liquid, then put the cloth to the baby's mouth. The baby opened its mouth, sucked on the towel, and swallowed. Philip felt like cheering. That was clever, Johnny, he said in surprise. Johnny grinned. I've done it before, when a nanny goat died before her kid was weaned, he said proudly. All the monks watched intently as Johnny repeated the simple action of dipping the towel and letting the baby suck. As he touched the towel to the baby's lips, some of the monks would open their own mouths, Philip saw with amusement. It was a slow way of feeding the baby, but no doubt feeding babies was a slow business anyway. Peter of Wareham, who had succumbed to the general fascination with the baby and consequently had forgotten to be critical of anything for some time, now recovered himself and said, it would be less trouble to find the child's mother. Francis said, I doubt it. The mother is probably unmarried and was overtaken in moral transgression. I imagine she is young. Perhaps she managed to keep her pregnancy secret. Then when her time was near, she came out into the forest and built a fire, gave birth alone, then abandoned the child to the wolves and went back to wherever she came from. She will make sure she can't be found. The baby had fallen asleep. On impulse, Philip took it from Johnny. He held it to his chest, supporting it with his hand, and rocked it. The poor thing, he said. The poor, poor thing. The urge to protect and care for the baby suffused him like a flush. He noticed that the monks were staring at him, astonished at his sudden display of tenderness. They had never seen him caress anyone, of course, for physical affection was strictly prohibited in the monastery. Obviously they had thought him incapable of it. Well, he thought, they know the truth now. Peter of Wareham spoke again. We'll have to take the child to Winchester then and try to find a foster mother. If this had been said by anyone else, Philip might not have been so quick to contradict it. But Peter said it, and Philip spoke hastily, and his life was never quite the same afterward. We're not going to give him to a foster mother, he said decisively. This child is a gift from God. He looked around at them all. The monks gazed back at him wide-eyed, hanging on his words. We'll take care of him ourselves, he went on. We'll feed him and teach him, and bring him up in the ways of God. Then when he is a man, he will become a monk himself, and that way we will give him back to God. There was a stunned silence. Then Peter said angrily, It's impossible. A baby cannot be brought up by monks. Philip caught his brother's eye, and they both smiled, sharing memories. When Philip spoke again, his voice was heavy with the weight of the past. Impossible? No, Peter. On the contrary. I'm quite sure it can be done, and so is my brother. We know from experience, don't we, Francis? On the day Philip now thought of as the last day, his father had come home wounded. Philip had been the first to see him, riding up the twisting hillside path to the little hamlet in mountainous North Wales. 6-year-old Philip ran out to meet him as usual. But this time, Dar did not swing his little boy up onto the horse in front of him.
He was riding slowly, slumped in the saddle, holding the reins in his right hand, his left arm hanging limp. His face was pale and his clothes were splashed with blood. Philip was at once intrigued and scared, for he had never seen his father appear weak. Da said, "Fetch your mother." When they got him into the house, Mam cut off his shirt. Philip was horrified. The sight of his thrifty mother willfully ruining good clothes was more shocking than the blood.
"Don't worry about me now,"
Da had said, but his normal bark had weakened to a murmur and nobody took any notice. Another shocking event, for normally his word was law.
"Leave me and get everyone up to the monastery," he said. "The damned English will be here soon."
There was a monastery with a church at the top of the hill, but Philip could not understand why they should go there when it was not even Sunday. Mam said, "If you lose any more blood, you won't be able to go anywhere, ever." But Auntie Gwen said she would raise the alarm and went out. Years later, when he thought about the events that followed, Philip realized that at this moment everyone had forgotten about him and his 4-year-old brother, Francis, and nobody thought to take them to the safety of the monastery. People were thinking of their own children and assumed that Philip and Francis were all right, because they were with their parents. But Da was bleeding to death and Mam was trying to save him, and so it happened that the English caught all 4 of them. Nothing in Philip's short experience of life had prepared him for the appearance of the 2 men-at-arms as they kicked the door open and burst into the 1-room house. In other circumstances they would not have been frightening, for they were the kind of big clumsy adolescents who mocked old women and abused Jews and got into fistfights outside alehouses at midnight. But now, Philip understood years later, when at last he was able to think objectively about that day, the 2 young men were possessed by bloodlust. They had been in a battle, they had heard men scream in agony and seen friends fall down dead, and they had been scared, literally, out of their wits. But they had won the battle and survived, and now they were in hot pursuit of their enemies, and nothing could satisfy them but more blood, more screaming, more wounds and more death. And all this was written on their twisted faces as they came into the room like foxes into a henhouse. They moved very fast, but Philip could remember each step forever afterward, as if it had all taken a very long time. Both men wore light armor, just a short vest of chainmail and a leather helmet with iron bands. Both had their swords drawn. One was ugly with a big bent nose and a squint, and his teeth were bared in a dreadful ape-like grin. The other had a luxuriant beard that was matted with blood, someone else's presumably, for he did not seem to be wounded. Both men scanned the room without breaking stride. Their merciless, calculating eyes dismissed Philip and Francis, noted Mam, and focused on Da. They were almost upon him before anyone else could move. Mam had been bending over him, tying a bandage to his left arm. She straightened up and turned on the intruders, her eyes blazing with hopeless courage. Da sprang to his feet and got his good hand to the hilt of his sword. Philip let out a cry of terror. The ugly man raised his sword above his head and brought it down, hilt first, on Mam's head, then pushed her aside without stabbing her, probably because he did not want to risk getting his blade stuck in a body while Da was still alive. Philip figured that out years later. At the time, he just ran to his mother, not understanding that she could no longer protect him. Mam stumbled, stunned, and the ugly man went by her, raising his sword again. Philip clung to his mother's skirts as she staggered, dazed, but he could not help looking at his father. Da got his weapon clear of its scabbard and raised it defensively. The ugly man struck downward and the 2 blades clashed, ringing like a bell. Like all small boys, Philip thought his father was invincible, and this was the moment when he learned the truth. Da was weak from loss of blood. When the 2 swords met, his dropped, and the attacker lifted his blade just a little and struck again quickly. The blow landed where the big muscles of Da's neck grew out of his broad shoulders. Philip began to scream when he saw the sharp blade slice into his father's body. The ugly man drew his arm back for a stab and thrust the point of the sword into Da's belly.
Paralyzed with terror, Philip looked up at his mother. His eyes met hers just as the other man, the bearded one, struck her down. She fell to the floor beside Philip with blood streaming from a head wound. The bearded man changed his grip on his sword, reversing it so that it pointed downward and holding it in both hands. Then he raised it high, almost like a man about to stab himself, and brought it down hard. There was a sickening crack of breaking bone as the point entered Mam's chest. The blade went in deep, so deep, Philip noted, even then when he was consumed by blind, hysterical fear, that it must have come through her back and stuck in the ground, fixing her to the floor like a nail. Philip looked wildly for his father again. He saw him slump forward over the ugly man's sword and spew out a huge gout of blood. His assailant stepped back and jerked at the sword, trying to disengage it. Dar stumbled another step and stayed with him. The ugly man gave a cry of rage and twisted his sword in Dar's belly. This time it came out. Dar fell to the floor and his hands went to his open abdomen, as if to cover the gaping wound. Philip had always imagined people's insides to be more or less solid, and he was mystified and nauseated by the ugly tubes and organs that were falling out of his father. The attacker lifted his sword high, point downward, over Dar's body, as the bearded man had over Mam, and delivered the final blow in the same way. The two Englishmen looked at one another, and quite unexpectedly, Philip read relief on their faces. Together they turned and looked at him and Francis. One nodded and the other shrugged, and Philip realized they were going to kill him and his brother by cutting them open with those sharp swords. And when he realized how much it was going to hurt, the terror boiled up inside him until he felt as if his head would burst. The man with blood in his beard stooped swiftly and picked Francis up by one ankle. He held him upside down in the air while the little boy screamed for his mother, not understanding that she was dead. The ugly man pulled his sword out of Dar's body and brought his arm back, ready to stab Francis through the heart. The blow was never struck. A commanding voice rang out, and the two men froze. The screaming stopped, and Philip realized it was he who had been doing it. He looked at the door and saw Abbot Peter standing there in his homespun robe, with the wrath of God in his eyes, holding a wooden cross in his hand like a sword. When Philip relived that day in his nightmares and woke up sweating and screaming in the dark, he would always be able to calm himself and eventually relax into sleep again by bringing to mind that final tableau and the way the screaming and the wounds had been swept aside by the unarmed man with the cross. Abbot Peter spoke again. Philip did not understand the language he used. It was English, of course, but the meaning was clear, for the two men looked ashamed, and the bearded one put Francis down quite gently. Still talking, the monk strode confidently into the room. The men-at-arms backed off a step, almost as if they were afraid of him, they with their swords and armor, and him with a wool robe and a cross. He turned his back on them, a gesture of contempt, and crouched to speak to Philip. His voice was matter-of-fact. "What's your name?"
"Philip."
"Ah, yes. I remember. And your brothers?"
"Francis."
"That's right." The abbot looked at the bleeding bodies on the earth floor.
"That's your mam, isn't it?"
"Yes," said Philip, and he felt panic come over him as he pointed to the mutilated body of his father and said,
"And that's my da."
"I know," the monk said soothingly. "You mustn't scream any more. You must answer my questions. Do you understand that they're dead?"
"I don't know,"
Philip said miserably. He knew what it meant when animals died, but how could that happen to Mam and Da? Abbot Peter said, "It's like going to sleep."
"But their eyes are open,"
Philip yelled.
"Hush!
We'd better close them, then."
"Yes,"
Philip said. He felt as if that would resolve something. Abbot Peter stood up, took Philip and Francis by the hand, and led them across the floor to their father's body. He knelt down and took Philip's right hand in his.
"I'll show you how," he said.
He moved Philip's hand over his father's face, but suddenly Philip was afraid to touch his father, because the body looked so strange, pale and slack and hideously wounded, and he snatched his hand away. Then he looked anxiously at Abbot Peter, a man no one disobeyed, but the abbot was not angry with him. "Come," he said gently, and took Philip's hand again. This time Philip did not resist. Holding Philip's forefinger between his own thumb and forefinger, the monk made the boy touch his father's eyelid and bring it down until it covered the dreadfully staring eyeball. Then the abbot released Philip's hand and said, "Close his other eye." Unaided now, Philip reached out, touched his father's eyelid, and closed it. Then he felt better. Abbot Peter said, "Shall we close your mam's eyes, too?"
"Yes."
They knelt beside her body. The abbot wiped blood off her face with his sleeve. Philip said,
"What about Francis?"
"Perhaps he should help, too," said the abbot.
"Do what I did, Francis,"
Philip said to his brother.
"Close mam's eyes like I close Da's, so she can sleep."
"Are they asleep?"
said Francis.
"No, but it's like sleeping,"
Philip said authoritatively.
"So she should have her eyes shut."
"All right, then,"
said Francis, and without hesitation he reached out a chubby hand and carefully closed his mother's eyes. Then the abbot picked them both up, one in each arm, and without another glance at the men-at-arms he carried them out of the house and all the way up the steep hillside path to the sanctuary of the monastery. He fed them in the monastery kitchen. Then, so that they should not be left idle with their thoughts, he told them to help the cook prepare the monk's supper. On the following day he took them to see their parents' bodies washed and dressed, and with the wounds cleaned and repaired and partly concealed, lying in coffins side by side in the nave of the church. There, too, were several of their relatives, for not all the villagers had made it to the monastery in time to escape the invading army. Abbot Peter took them to the funeral, and made sure they watched the two coffins being lowered into the single grave. When Philip cried, Francis cried too. Someone hushed them, but Abbot Peter said, "Let them weep." Only after that, when they had taken to their hearts the knowledge that their parents had really gone and were never coming back, did he at last talk about the future. Among their relatives there was not a single family left entire. In every case, either the father or the mother had been killed. There were no relations to look after the boys. That left two options. They could be given, or even sold, to a farmer who would use them as slave labor until they grew old enough and big enough to run away. Or they could be given to God. It was not unknown for small boys to enter a monastery. The usual age was about 11, and the lower limit around 5, for the monks were not set up to cope with babies. Sometimes the boys were orphans, sometimes they had lost just one parent, and sometimes their parents had too many sons. Normally the family would give the monastery a substantial gift along with the child, a farm, a church, or even a whole village. In cases of direst poverty the gift might be waived. However, Philip's father had left a modest hill farm, so the boys were not a charity case. Abbot Peter proposed that the monastery should take over the boys and the farm. The surviving relatives agreed, and the deal was sanctioned by the Prince of Gwynedd, Griffith ap Gynnin, who was temporarily humbled but not permanently deposed by the invading army of King Henry, which had killed Philip's father. The abbot knew a lot about grief, but for all his wisdom he was not prepared for what happened to Philip. After a year or so, when grief had seemed to pass, and the two boys had settled into the life of the monastery, Philip became possessed by a kind of implacable rage. Conditions in the hilltop community were not bad enough to justify his anger. There was food and clothing and a fire in the dormitory in winter, and even a little love and affection, and the strict discipline and tedious rituals at least made for order and stability. But Philip began to act as if he had been unjustly imprisoned. He disobeyed orders, subverted the authority of monastic officers at every opportunity, stole food, broke eggs, loosed horses, mocked the infirm, and insulted his elders. The one offence he stopped short of was sacrilege, and because of that the abbot forgave him everything else. And in the end he simply grew out of it. One Christmas he looked back over the past 12 months and realized that he had not spent a single night in the punishment cell all year. There was no single reason for his return to normality. The fact that he got interested in his lessons probably helped. The mathematical theory of music fascinated him, and even the way Latin verbs were conjugated had a certain satisfying logic. He had been put to work helping the cellarer, the monk who had to provide all the supplies the monastery needed, from sandals to seed, and that, too, compelled his interest. He developed a hero-worshipping attachment for Brother John, a handsome, muscular young monk who seemed the epitome of learning, holiness, wisdom, and kindness. Either in imitation of John, or from his own inclination, or both, he began to find some kind of solace in the daily round of prayers and services. And so he slipped into adolescence with the organization of the monastery on his mind, and the holy harmonies in his ears. In their studies, both Philip and Francis were far ahead of any boys of their own age that they knew, but they assumed this was because they lived in the monastery and had been educated more intensively. At this stage, they did not realize they were exceptional. Even when they began to do much of the teaching in the little school, and take their own lessons from the abbot himself instead of the pedantic old novice master, they thought they were ahead only because they had got such an early start. When he looked back on his youth, it seemed to Philip that there had been a brief golden age, a year or perhaps less, between the end of his rebellion and the onslaught of fleshly lust. Then came the agonizing era of impure thoughts, nocturnal emissions, dreadfully embarrassing sessions with his confessor, who was the abbot, endless penances and mortification of the flesh with scourges. Lust never completely ceased to afflict him, but it did eventually become less important, so that it bothered him only now and again, on the rare occasions when his mind and body were idle, like an old injury that still hurts in wet weather. Francis had fought this battle a little later, and although he had not confided to Philip on the subject, Philip had the impression that Francis had struggled less bravely against evil desires, and had taken his defeats rather too cheerfully. However, the main thing was that they had both made their peace with the passions that were the greatest enemy of the monastic life. As Philip worked with the cellarer, so Francis worked for the prior, Abbot Peter's deputy. When the cellarer died, Philip was 21, and despite his youth, he took over the job. And when Francis reached the age of 21, the abbot proposed to create a new post for him, that of sub-prior. But this proposal precipitated a crisis. Francis begged to be excused the responsibility, and while he was at it, he asked to be released from the monastery. He wanted to be ordained as a priest and serve God in the world outside. Philip was astonished and horrified. The idea that one of them might leave the monastery had never occurred to him, and now it was as disconcerting as if he had learned that he was the heir to the throne. But after much hand-wringing and heart-searching, it happened, and Francis went off into the world, before long to become chaplain to the Earl of Gloucester. Before this happened, Philip had seen his future very simply, when he had thought of it at all. He would be a monk, live a humble and obedient life, and in his old age perhaps become abbot and strive to live up to the example set by Peter. Now he wondered whether God intended some other destiny for him. He remembered the parable of the talents. God expected his servants to increase his kingdom, not merely to conserve it. With some trepidation he shared these thoughts with Abbot Peter, fully aware that he risked a reprimand for being puffed up with pride. To his surprise, the abbot said, "I've been wondering how long it would take you to realize this. Of course you're destined for something else. Born within sight of a monastery, orphaned at 6, raised by monks, made cellarer at 21. God does not take that much trouble over the formation of a man who is going to spend his life in a small monastery, on a bleak hilltop, in a remote mountain principality. There isn't enough scope for you here. You must leave this place." Philip was stunned by this, but before leaving the abbot, a question occurred to him, and he blurted it out.
If this monastery is so unimportant, why did God put you here?
Abbot Peter smiled.
Perhaps to take care of you.
Later that year the abbot went to Canterbury to pay his respects to the archbishop, and when he came back he said to Philip,
I have given you to the prior of Kingsbridge.
Philip was daunted. Kingsbridge Priory was one of the biggest and most important monasteries in the land. It was a cathedral priory. Its church was a cathedral church, the seat of a bishop, and the bishop was technically the abbot of the monastery, although in practice it was ruled by its prior.
Prior James is an old friend,
Abbot Peter told Philip. In the last few years he has become rather dispirited. I don't know why. Anyway, Kingsbridge needs young blood. In particular, James is having trouble with one of his cells, a little place in the forest, and he desperately needs a completely reliable man to take over the cell and set it back on the path of godliness.
So I'm to be prior of the cell,
Philip said in surprise.
The abbot nodded. And if we're right in thinking that God has much work for you to do, we can expect that he will help you to resolve whatever problems this cell has.
And if we're wrong?
You can always come back here and be my cellarer. But we're not wrong, my son. You'll see.
His farewells were tearful. He had spent 17 years here, and the monks were his family, more real to him now than the parents who had been savagely taken from him. He would probably never see these monks again, and he was sad. Kingsbridge overawed him at first. The walled monastery was bigger than many villages. The cathedral church was a vast, gloomy cavern. The prior's house, a small palace. But once he got used to its sheer size, he saw the signs of that dispiritedness that Abbot Peter had noted in his old friend, the prior. The church was visibly in need of major repairs. The prayers were gabbled hastily, the rules of silence were breached constantly, and there were too many servants, more servants than monks. Philip quickly got over being awed and became angry. He wanted to take Prior James by the throat and shake him and say, "How dare you do this? How dare you give hasty prayers to God? How dare you allow novices to play at dice and monks to keep pet dogs? How dare you live in a palace surrounded by servants while God's church is falling into ruin?" He said nothing of the kind, of course. He had a brief, formal interview with Prior James, a tall, thin, stooped man who seemed to have the weight of the world's troubles on his rounded shoulders. Then he talked to the sub-prior, Remigius. At the start of the conversation, Philip hinted that he thought the priory might be overdue for some changes, expecting that its deputy leader would agree wholeheartedly. But Remigius looked down his nose at Philip, as if to say, "Who do you think you are?" and changed the subject. Remigius said that the cell of St. John in the Forest had been established 3 years earlier with some land and property, and it should have been self-supporting by now, but in fact it was still dependent on supplies from the mother house. There were other problems. A deacon who happened to spend the night there had criticized the conduct of the services. Travelers alleged they had been robbed by monks in that area. There were rumors of impurity. The fact that Remigius was unable or unwilling to give exact details was just another sign of the indolent way the whole organization was being run. Philip left, trembling with rage. A monastery was supposed to glorify God. If it failed to do that, it was nothing. Kingsbridge Priory was worse than nothing. It shamed God by its slothfulness. But Philip could do nothing about it. The best he could hope for was to reform one of Kingsbridge's cells. On the 2-day ride to the cell in the forest, he mulled over the scanty information he had been given and prayerfully considered his approach. He would do well to tread softly at first, he decided. Normally a prior was elected by the monks, but in the case of a cell which was just an outpost of the main monastery, the prior of the mother house might simply choose. So Philip had not been asked to submit himself for election, and that meant he could not count on the goodwill of the monks. He would have to feel his way cautiously. He needed to learn more about the problems afflicting the place before he could decide how best to solve them.
He had to win the respect and trust of the monks, especially those who were older than he and who might resent his position. Then, when his information was complete and his leadership secure,